This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 7, Episode 28, Games versus Drills. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we talk about different types of practices, games, drills, and things in between those that can help you improve and how you can use them at different times and with different personalities. We also talk about playing one day or limited over cricket and how you can get into the squad, what traits you need to do that, and what happens if you're hitting the ball well in nets but you can't transfer that form into the middle. Listen into this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show to find out. Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, your guide, of course, to better cricket. Doesn't matter who you are or where you are, we're here to help you out for the next half an hour or so. My name's David Hinchliffe. I look after things here, and helping me to help you are two very fine cricket coaches. The first is the Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garras.
Hello, all.
And secondly, it's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Lavers, how's it going?
Very well, thank you very much.
And this week, I wanted to get into talking about what people do at practice, and specifically the difference between playing games, small-sided games with a specific aim, I suppose, or making a game out of nets or something like that, and drills, you know, when you're working on something very, very specific, which is less open-ended. So how do you use those two different ways of helping people develop their cricket? And where do you find the balance between the two?
Well, I think it's a little bit about your definition of those two things. I'm sure that they can mean different things to different people. And some of the drills that maybe you and I use, David, other people would consider to be games. So, it's a bit of definition. But if you think about drills, really, drills are about repeating and challenging a skill in order to develop them. And then I suppose the games that you put on top are creating some situations, some intentions, some scoring stuff that goes alongside, which allows people to have a bit of fun, but also to monitor that skill within a game context, because ultimately that's where we're going to take it. But you know, my definition of drills and games may differ from yours, may differ from other people, but I would always start with drills to build the skill, and then use a game to test its effectiveness, to test its transferability into a competitive or a scoring or a monitored situation to see how they go. So the starting point would be to build the skill, the second point would be to test it, and then you might need to go back and build it a little bit more or layer it up, as we talk about so readily on the show.
And how does that change over time, Lavers? How do you find working with different types of players changes the way that you balance these things out?
I guess, as well as players at different stages of their development, as it were, would require different types of stimulus or different types of drills or games or whatever it might be that are pitched at a slightly different level. Also, different personalities have different interest levels and attention spans and different ways of kind of taking to an exercise that you're asking them to do. And there are certain personalities, and you'll know people like this, who, if you put them into any kind of repetitive situation, they will thrive, where there are the polar opposites. And if you put them into anything repetitive that seems to be potentially a bit tedious to them, three or four balls in, batting, bowling, fielding, whatever it is, they're already drifting away from you. So it's not only is it trying to find what is relevant to their level of performance and or their stage of development, but it's also trying to find something that's going to engage them. And it's going to be enjoyable as well, but it's got to be productive. And if they're not able to focus concentration, from one angle you might think that's not being productive, but possibly actually that's challenging them from a focus point of view as well. So there are lots of different ways to look at different things. As Gareth has already said, the terminology of games versus drills is one that can be discussed all day long. So your own perception of it is essentially what's key. But we talk a lot about trying to cover the spectrum, and people have at the beginner end will probably work in different areas of the spectrum more often than people at the more advanced end. It's not necessarily games at one and drills at the other, though. I mean, I think it'll depend on the individual and how they like to learn.
I've got a great example of that, if that's of use. It's Andrew Flintoff was classic in that. You know, if you think about some of his injuries that he picked up over the years when he was bowling, a lot of them came from his front foot placement being really really close. So he was always going against his ankle and going against his knee. And as a result of that, he had quite a lot of shearing going on in both of those two joints. And for him to go through the usual methodology, the usual techniques of trying to straighten that foot out, where you're very sort of like technically based, was something that he did and found absolutely fruitless. It was something that he didn't enjoy. It was completely tedious. It became something that he dreaded rather than doing, and as a result his foot position didn't change so much. The only time that we had any joy with that for any sustained period of time was when we introduced like chucking a ball at him just as he was about to bowl, and almost took his mind off of his foot placement and made it a bit of fun, and put some moving targets down and just made it a bit of a giggle type of thing. And all of a sudden the foot placement started to address itself and get into a place where it wasn't going to have as detrimental an issue with his mechanics as it had in the previous time. So yeah, you know, there's an example of somebody that you take that tedious drill workout, you build more fun around, and all of a sudden you get a more positive result.
And how important is it to be able to, no matter which way you go as a player, how is it important to be able to reflect on what does work for you and what doesn't work for you, and be able to move more towards the things that are more effective, rather than just listening to what the coach has a particular drill or a particular game that is their pet thing, and they want to keep a player doing it even if they're not enjoying it and it's not getting much from it?
I think it's really important, because the player ultimately is going to know more about themselves than the coach. The coach, the best situation for a coach is that he's got, say, 12, 15 players that he works with. Obviously, that individual is just merely himself, so he'll know himself. And I think the skill of a coach is to allow that person to give you some insight into how they like to learn, as well as building your own view of how they like to learn, but get that insight from themselves too. So you know, coaches I think are getting better at that. I think players, we need to encourage them to get better at speaking about that, because a lot of people wouldn't necessarily be comfortable telling a coach how they prefer to learn. And we've got to get better at eliciting that type of information from the player themselves, because it's hugely important in the way that we then go about our business.
And I guess that comes back to one of the things that we talk about a lot as well, which is what a player wants compared to what a player needs, and how you find the balance between the two. It's not necessarily the case that a player always wants what they need, and it's not always the case that a coach provides what they need to a player first time, even though they think they might know the answer. So that's a difficult thing, isn't it?
That's often the difference between those good players and great players, or people that excel at the level they're at against those that maybe do reasonably well, is that they're able to identify things that are really going to benefit them and going to make a real positive difference to their performance, rather than getting drawn into what they're being told to do or what they want to do. And that's very difficult, obviously, if your coach is quite strong-minded and thinks you should be doing a certain thing, or even if you're the other way and you're 100% focused on enjoyment, yet you want to get better, but the enjoyment is your number one thing. And so it's difficult to manage yourself and manage towards your coach as well if you have that understanding. But it's great if you do, and you can appreciate that there are things that will work for you and will make a big difference, as opposed to just things that will occupy time in the end.
Yeah, that's a tough thing, isn't it? Because sometimes your instinct, certainly my instinct as a coach, is to think, Is this a good use of time or not? And a player might think it is a good use of time, and you might disagree. But you're not necessarily right just because you disagree. So it's a difficult way to find your way through that, isn't it?
Well, that's the art of coaching, isn't it? It's the art of communication. It's the art of coaching. It's what takes the time, but ultimately is the thing that gets the best results. And as we know, these individual things, they take time to pick up upon, don't they? And that's why it is an art. You know, that's why we can't apply just a single science or a single approach to everybody, because whilst that would be lovely and would be time efficient, it's not necessarily the way that people nor sport runs.
Yeah, people are all different. Who'd have thought it?
Yeah, absolutely. Who'd have thought it? I've got a person who's next to me who, despite the fact that I've got a lot to do with how he got on this planet, is very different from me.
Is he taller?
He will be taller. He'll certainly be thinner, and he's definitely going to have more hair. So there you go.
Right, before it starts to get too snippy, let's do the yes-no round. That's three questions that can only be answered yes or no, no matter how much more the team want to say. I've got the question, so let's fire away. First question, failure is good.
Yes.
Yes.
Second question, conflict is useful.
Yes.
Yes.
Third question, 2020 is the future.
Yes.
Yes.
That's the greatest yes no round ever.
Brilliant.
Time now for the questions section. We open up the mailbag and we pick out a couple of questions that have been sent in by listeners to the show, or maybe readers to the Pitch Vision Academy website. We do our best to answer those questions, and whether we do that correctly or not, we do offer a prize for the best question of the week, which is an online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And Ravi sent in a question, and Ravi says, I have a club team for one day cricket and I want to be selected in the squad for that team. Can you give me any tips for being selected for one day cricket?
Yeah, I think the two areas really that apply in all one day cricket, irrespective of what your club's like, irrespective of what your your coach wants or your captain wants, is I can't imagine that any one day captain won't want somebody who's a fantastic fielder. So, you know, I've selected players in the past, even at professional level, because their fielding has been so strong that they would likely to influence that game of cricket massively. So your fielding is a real big starting point for that. The second one for me is having the ability in one day cricket, and if we're talking about 50 over cricket, it's great to be able to smack the ball out of the park, but also if you can establish a way that you can score at a strike rate of 100 in your own way, then that will make you very, very easy to select in a side. So that 100 can be made up by whacking every sixth ball out the park if you want, or it could be made up of putting twos and threes together. It could be made up of being great at turning the strike over, which we talked about last week. So to me, batting around 100 can get you a position in the batting lineup from 1 to 10, and also fielding can be the decision that tips it your way, can be the influence that tips it your way when it comes between you and somebody else.
Lavers, I presume limited overs cricket is the thing that you have the most experience helping people move towards, right?
Yeah, it would be really, and that's for the majority of the cricketing world, I guess. Limited overs cricket is kind of what they grow up on, and that's their bread and butter, isn't it? That's what they do the majority of the time. So I guess that's the kind of thing that most people are exposed to. From my own point of view, I think it's from a batting perspective, You can talk about having players that can adapt to different situations, which is useful. And it's obviously, if you're trying to be in a side or trying to pick a side, you've got someone who can play more than one role, that's useful. And whether that is adaptability that a batter has and you can develop in yourself as a batter, or you see in a batsman, adaptability is a really high skill. I actually remember listening to someone on Sky Sports, and I'm not going to be able to remember who it was, but it was a discussion about adaptability versus transferability. So can you adapt your skills to fit different situations and different scenarios, which is ongoing, kind of being regarded as something that's very important? Or do you just have a particular skill set which transfers to every situation anyway? And that was the kind of the Coley, Root, Williamson discussion of those guys have transferable skills which apply into different environments, whereas other people adapt their skills to different environments. So I'd be looking for someone who can, and again, not everyone, but if you can play more than one role in the side as a batter, then that would be a really, really useful thing. And obviously the idea of a three-dimensional cricketer is something that comes up quite a lot. And Gareth has already talked about the fielding. If you've got something you can offer with the bat or with the ball, which isn't your major suit, then again, that's great. I'd still be thinking you want your out-and-out best bowlers, really. Especially you're going to want four of them. So I'd be thinking you want three or four of your absolute best bowlers. So if you can fit into that category again, fantastic. And you're probably going to have a bit of leeway with your out-and-out best batters as well. But the fielding side of things is something that isn't enormously difficult to have a positive impact on. It's not that difficult to make yourself a little bit better, or train a little bit harder, or get a little bit fitter, or whatever it might be. So whatever goes on, that's something that you should always have in the back of your mind, is that should be as good as it can be.
You both mentioned fielding there. If someone was looking to push their fielding forward as quickly as possible, what would be the sort of the big things to look at first to make sure that you've absolutely get the biggest improvements towards becoming a much better fielder?
I would say that everyone, well, not everyone, most people are very good at stopping a ball that goes straight to them. And most people are good at catching a ball that goes straight to them. So the improvement I often would start with, and it's not going to be with everyone because people have different strengths and weaknesses, but often the kind of movement and mobility type area of fielding, which is going to make every ball a little bit easier to pick up or a little bit easier to catch if you can move that a little bit faster and get that a little bit closer to it. That's generally the area that I would start with, and the best fielders are invariably the best movers. Or on the other side, they might be great anticipators as well, but that's a slightly different thing to train and maybe a little bit more complicated. So I would think about basic movement patterns of being able to move quickly in different directions, being able to move in a low position, being able to move in high positions, just generally working on all the different types of things you might have to do in the various different scenarios you might find yourself in the field, and you will have a good idea of where you might field, and hopefully if you can, we will no doubt serve more than one purpose in a field, you can think about those movement patterns and think about how you might be able to improve them or develop them in your own game.
I would go more to, I think that's a brilliant point. That would be my second point. My first point would be catching. Because if I've got 11 guys out on that pitch that I know are solid catchers, and yes, catching is limited by movement in certain contexts, but if I've got technically some good catchers of a high ball and a flat ball, then I'm pretty happy. So every time a ball goes up in the air, or it goes an inch off the ground and it goes straight at people, then because hopefully we'll be a good side that places their fielders pretty well, if I've got catches, then that's fine. And that's my starting point, is generally around the catching. If we can become better catchers than we were as an individual, then you put yourself in a pretty good position to sit your hand up and say you should be selecting me, because any captain will want that ball off the best player that goes up in the air to be taken. That's the best way of saving runs, is by getting wickets.
fabulous answer. Okay. Right, next question's from Robin, and Robin has a classic problem, but it's definitely worth talking about again. Robin says, "Sir, I'm hitting the ball well in nets, but in matches my hitting ability becomes poor. I have much less courage in games. How can I fix this?"
I think this is one for you, David. Well, I was going to say it's one for you, David, because you do a lot of transferring net play into match play, don't you, with your club? And obviously utilising pitch vision as well is a really good way to bridge that gap and to also analyse the success you're having in a net. So when someone says they're hitting a ball well in a net, when you do a lot of your net sessions using pitch vision, you actually have sort of quantifiable feedback that says actually you were hitting the ball well or you weren't hitting the ball well, because there's a bit more information than just what happened between the ball hitting the bat and the ball hitting the side net. So how do you do it? Because that's the kind of thing you do day in, day out, isn't it?
Yeah, we always try. It's the age-old problem, isn't it, with nets, in that you just don't know where the ball's gone. So we try and make the outcomes a little bit clearer for people. And sometimes that's setting down a target, or sometimes that's having the player judge their own view of what the outcome was. And it might be that based on how well they hit the ball rather than whether they hit the ball into the gap or in the air or whatever. So because that's quite hard to judge. And actually, recently we did some analysis on comparing actual averages with the averages that the batsmen had come up with while they were in nets during winter training. And surprise, surprise, the averages that the batsmen came up with in the nets were a lot higher than their actual averages. But what was interesting to me was that their strike rate seemed to be about right. It was a little bit higher, but generally speaking, the strike rate was about correct. So it shows me that batsmen can, if they are engaged in the net rather than just hitting the ball, seeing the ball, hitting the ball, seeing the ball, hitting the ball, if they're engaged in thinking about what the outcome might be, it can help you understand what's happening in the net to be able to transfer it into the middle. And I think it's clearly a mental thing. When you're in that net, you do feel safe and enclosed, don't you? So it's clearly a mental thing. So to be able to sort of mentally remove that net is a really useful tool to be able to improve your practice.
I think the way from a mental point that I would go with would be that is to embrace the fact that you are going to fail, and get, you know, and depends what your definition of failure is. But for some people, getting out is deemed to be a failure, irrespective of the number that they've got. They sort of fear it a bit. And the fact is that getting out is a massive part of the game. It's intrinsic within the game. You know, very rarely do you have a game of cricket that lasts for 50 overs where people don't, six or seven people at minimum don't get out. You know, that's a rarity. So the fact is that it's what you do before it. And it sounds to me as if in the nets, because you haven't got that consequence of getting out, that you're happy to play in the way that you do, and you're striking the ball well as a consequence of that. But in a game, there's no reason to change that, because one day cricket in some ways allows you to go out there and play with a little bit of freedom. And you know, I would rather a batter come off once every three or four games and contribute in a significant fashion to the team and fail in three. I'd be quite happy for that to happen. So again, you probably need to change your perspective a little bit around failure and what is failure. And as a consequence of that, you'll probably find that you play in a freer way than you did.
How do you deal with good net batsmen who can't seem to transfer it, Lavers?
In my experience, a lot of the time, the good net batsmen are generally good indoor net batsmen as opposed to grass net batsmen. And it's often been the surface that has contributed to that. Obviously, in this case, it's difficult to know, and I would imagine there's some kind of outdoor nets as well, which is good, especially this time of year. Well, we don't know where Robin's coming from, do we? I don't think. Okay, so he'll be netting outside on similar conditions you'd have thought anyway. So you looking at the different variables, aren't you? And the variables would be: is the surface drastically different? Is the level of bowling drastically different? Is the ball being used any different? Is it that you're suddenly facing a new ball in a match situation, and in a game someone's thrown an old ball and maybe there's a variation there that you're not used to seeing quite so much? So it's just trying to separate the difference, and it may be that the main difference is that there is that added pressure of a match situation, there is that added expectation, or there's that different rhythm of a game in a match situation. That's one of the things that a lot of people use to excel in their net environment is the rhythm of facing a ball every 20 seconds, 25 seconds, whatever it might be, rather than just being made to wait that little bit longer, which for some people helps them and for others seems to be have a negative impact sometimes.
And the more you can get out of the net environment and into a middle practice environment, the better that is for you, because you're in that open situation and you can work out ways to build up your confidence. And also, if you're practicing against guys who you play with normally, then you can see how easy it can be sometimes to pick up those singles, to put the ball into a gap when you're driving instead of hitting it straight at a fielder. And you can sort of build confidence in your own game, so you're not so fearful of playing your shots that you would do in nets, that you get completely tied up in your own mind and stop trying to score runs at all, which you do see happen quite a lot with net players. So being out in the middle and being out in the open often helps you out as well, because you can play around with what works for you and not have that pesky net blocking everything off. I'd like to welcome back to the show for the second week, Yazi Gilani. We were going to talk a little bit about teamwork this week.
Yeah, that's right.
And so what was on my mind regarding that was that cricket is a very individual sport, isn't it? You know, you're batting one-on-one against a bowler and vice versa. And even when you're fielding, you pretty much do it on your own, apart from the odd occasion. So how important to you is teamwork?
Teamwork is really very important in a team game, as we all know that every player is important in the team. And when we talk about teamwork, we know that the importance of each player, like a bowler or the batsman or the fielder and the wicketkeeper as well. So everybody is having their own goals, but the final goal is the same for everyone. It's the winning. So when we talk about teamwork, it's more about cooperation with each other.
What's a good example of that cooperating in a cricketing environment?
Yeah, so when we know, like, we can see that everybody is not can give 100% in at every day. So, like, if a batsman gets failed one day, so the other player can take the responsibility and, you know, take the scoreboards running. And when we talk about bowling, if some bowler is not doing well the same day, so the other fielders can support them and do good fielding and, you know, cooperate with each other and, you know, stop the score.
And how do you develop as a coach? Or even if you're a player in a team, how you develop that team into a unit rather than just a group of individuals who get together to play cricket?
See, we need to explain them the meaning of teamwork, like how they can support each other, how can they, you know, overshadow each other's weaknesses and take the responsibility of the particular game. And they should not blame each other if somebody is weak that day, or we should not feel jealous also, you know, if somebody is performing well the same day. Because we need to explain all the players in the team, like the goal is common for everyone. So we need to overshadow the weaknesses of each other. We need to support. We need to, you know, cooperate with the, with each other to reach the common goal. We need to give the chance to the player who is, you know, really performing well that day. Sometimes the player, a weaker player, needs to sacrifice their wicket to give the chance to the better player who is tick on the wicket and, you know, who is able to watch the ball very, you know, widely and is ready to face the same bowler which the other weaker player is not able to. So sometimes we need to sacrifice also. But and when they are in the dressing room or on the ground, the good players can share their experiences also of the last games or maybe the problems they have faced on the ground or on the pitch. So all these things, you know, involves teamwork.
And that is just about all we've got time for on the show this week. Before we go, there is one thing we need to do, which is decide on the winner of this week's competition, the online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And the two questions up this week are Ravi's question about playing in one day or limited over cricket, and Robin's question about hitting well in nets but not so well in games. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
I'm going to go with Robin's question. I thought that it was a good one because it's something that most people probably experience, if not some of the time. Some of us experienced it a lot of the time. So hopefully there's a couple of tips in there for you, Robin, that you can take advantage of.
Yeah, well done. Keep going on that journey. You'll get there in the end, I'm sure. And Gareth, if someone was listening in and were thinking to themselves, you know, I'd like to have my question answered and maybe even win that prize, how could they get in touch with us?
They could give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email on coach@pitchvision.com.
That's correct. You can also find us on social media. Our Facebook is facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. And our Twitter is @pitchvisionacad. You can listen to the show every week by subscribing. Just go into your favourite podcast app on your phone or your tablet or your computer and do a search for Pitch Vision Academy. Tap on the subscribe button and you'll get the show every week. It's free. It comes out on Fridays. And if you want to get the show notes, stream the show online, download the original file, or do many, many other things in that vein, then head over to pitchvision.com/academy and click on the podcast link for all the details. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavis.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers, fellas.